Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Martell, reading The Runaway Skyscraper by Murray Leinster. Part 2. It was very still in the office, except for the flickering outside. Everything seemed very much as usual. The electric light burned steadily, but Estelle was sobbing with fright, and Arthur was vainly trying to console her.
"Have I gone crazy?" she demanded between her sobs.
"Not unless I've gone mad too," said Arthur soothingly. The excitement had quite a soothing effect upon him. He had ceased to feel afraid, but was simply waiting to see what had happened. "We're way back before the founding of New York now, and still going strong."
"Are you sure that's what has happened?"
"If you'll look outside," he suggested, "you'll see the seasons following each other in reverse order. One moment the snow covers the ground, then you catch a glimpse of autumn foliage, then summer follows, and next spring." Estelle glanced out of the window and covered her eyes.
"Not a house," she said despairingly. "Not a building. Nothing, nothing, nothing."
Arthur slipped his arm about her and patted hers comfortingly.
It's all right," he reassured her. "We'll bring up presently, and there will be. There's nothing to be afraid of."
She rested her head on his shoulder and sobbed hopelessly for a little while longer, but presently quieted. Then suddenly realizing that Arthur's arm was about her and that she was crying on his shoulder, she sprang away, blushing crimson. Arthur walked to the window.
"Look there," he exclaimed, but it was too late. "I'll swear to it, I saw the half moon. Hudson's ship," he declared excitedly. "We're way back now, and don't seem to be slacking up either."
Estelle came to the window by his side. The rapidly changing scene before her made her gasp. It was no longer possible to distinguish night from day. A wavering streak, moving first to the right and then to the left, showed where the sun flashed across the sky.
"What makes the sun wobble so?" she asked.
"Moving north and south of the equator," Arthur explained casually. "When it's farther south to the left, there's always snow on the ground. When it's farther right, it's summer. See how green it is?" A few moments' observation corroborated his statement.
"I'd say," Arthur remarked reflectively, "that it takes about 15 seconds for the sun to make the round trip from the farthest north to the farthest south."
He felt his pulse. "Do you know the normal rate of the heartbeat? We can judge time that way. A clock will go all to pieces, of course."
"Why did your watch explode? And the clock?"
"Running forward in time unwinds a clock, doesn't it?" asked Arthur. "It follows, of course, that when you move it backward in time, it winds up, and when you move it too far back, you wind it so tightly the spring just breaks to pieces."
He paused a moment, his fingers on his pulse. "Yes, it takes about 15 seconds for all the four seasons to pass. That means we're going backward in time about 4 years a minute. If we go on at this rate another hour, we'll be back in the time of the Northmen, and we'll be able to tell if they did discover America after all."
"Funny, we don't hear any noises," Estelle observed. She had caught some of Arthur's calmness.
"It passes so quickly that though our ears hear it, we don't separate the sounds. If you'll notice, you do hear a sort of humming. It's very high-pitched, though."
Estelle listened, but could hear nothing.
"No matter," said Arthur. "It's probably a little higher than your ears will catch. Lots of people can't hear a bat squeak."
"I never could," said Estelle. "Out in the country, where I come from, other people could hear them, but I couldn't."
They stood a while in silence, watching.
"When are we going to stop?" asked Estelle uneasily. "It seems as if we're going to keep on indefinitely."
"I guess we'll stop all right," Arthur reassured her. "It's obvious that whatever it was only affected our own building, or we'd see some other one with us. It looks like a fault or a flaw in the rock the building rests on. That can only give so far."
Estelle was silent for a moment.
"I can't be sane," she burst out semi-hysterically. "This can't be happening."
"You aren't crazy," said Arthur sharply. "You're sane as I am. Just something queer is happening. Now buck up. Say your multiplication table. Say anything you know. Say something sensible and you'll know you're all right. But don't get frightened now. There'll be plenty to get frightened about later."
The grimness in his tone alarmed Estelle. "What are you afraid of?" she asked quickly.
"Time enough to worry when it happens," Arthur retorted briefly.
"You aren't afraid we'll go back before the beginning of the world, are you?"
asked Estelle in a sudden access of fright. Arthur shook his head.
"Tell me," said Estelle more quietly, getting a grip on herself. "I won't mind, but please tell me."
Arthur glanced at her. Her face was pale, but there was more resolution in it than he had expected to find.
"I'll tell you then," he said reluctantly. "We're going back a little faster than we were, and the flaw seems to be a deeper one than I thought. At the roughest kind of an estimate, we're all of 1,000 years before the discovery of America now, and I think nearer 3 or 4. And we're gaining speed all the time, so though I am as sure as I can be sure of anything that we'll stop this cave-in eventually, I don't know where. It's like a crevasse in the earth opened by an earthquake, which may be only a few feet deep or maybe hundreds of yards or even a mile or two. We started off smoothly. We're going at a terrific rate. What will happen when we stop?"
Estelle caught her breath.
"What?"
she asked quietly.
"I don't know," said Arthur in an irritated tone to cover his apprehension. "How could I know?"
Estelle turned from him to the window again.
"Look," she said, pointing. The flickering had begun again. While they stared, hope springing up once more in their hearts, it became more pronounced. Soon they could distinctly see the difference between day and night. They were slowing up. The white snow on the ground remained there for an appreciable time, and autumn lasted quite a while. They could catch the flashes of the sun as it made its revolutions now, instead of its seeming like a ribbon of fire. At last, day lasted all of 15 or 20 minutes. It grew longer and longer. Then half an hour, then an hour, the sun wavered in mid-heaven and was still. Far below them, the watchers in the tower of the skyscraper saw trees swaying and bending in the wind. Though there was not a house or a habitation to be seen, and a dense forest covered all of Manhattan Island, such of the world as they could see looked normal. Wherever, or rather in whatever epoch of time they were, they'd arrived. Arthur caught at Estelle's arm, and the two made a dash for the elevators. Fortunately, one was standing still, the door open on their floor. The elevator boy had deserted his post and was looking with all the rest of the occupants of the building at the strange landscape that surrounded them. No sooner had the pair reached the car, however, than the boy came hurrying along the corridor, 3 or 4 other people following him also at a run. Without a word, the boy rushed inside, the others crowded after him, and the car shot downward, all of the newcomers panting from their sprint. Theirs was the first car to reach the bottom. They rushed out and to the western door. Here, where they had been accustomed to see Madison Square spread out before them, a clearing of perhaps half an acre in extent showed itself.
where their eyes instinctively looked for the dark bronze fountain near which soapbox orators aforetime held sway, they saw a tent, a wigwam of hides and bark gaily painted. And before the wigwam were two or three brown-skinned Indians, utterly petrified with astonishment. Behind the first wigwam were others, painted like the first with daubs of brightly colored clay. From them, too, Indians issued and stared in incredulous amazement, their eyes growing wider and wider. When the group of white people confronted the Indians, there was a moment's death-like silence. Then, with a wild yell, the Redskins broke and ran, not stopping to gather together their belongings, nor pausing for even a second glance at the weird strangers who invaded their domain. Arthur took two or three deep breaths of the fresh air, and found himself even then comparing its quality with that of the city. Estelle stared about her with unbelieving eyes. She turned and saw the great bulk of the office building behind her, then faced this small clearing with a virgin forest on its farther side. She found herself trembling from some undefined cause. Arthur glanced at her. He saw the trembling and knew she would have a fit of nerves in a moment if something did not come up demanding instant attention. "Oh, we'd better take a look at this village," he said in an offhand voice. "We can probably find out how long ago it is from the weapons and so on." He grasped her arm firmly and led her in the direction of the tents. The other people left behind displayed their emotions in different ways. Two or three of them, women, sat frankly down on the steps and indulged in tears of bewilderment, fright, and relief in a peculiar combination defying analysis. Two or three of the men swore in shaken voices. Meantime, the elevators inside the building were rushing and clanging, and the hall filled with a white-faced mob, desperately anxious to find out what had happened and why. The people poured out of the door and stared about blankly. There was a peculiar expression of doubt on every one of their faces. Each one was asking himself if he were awake, and having proved that by pinches openly administered, the next query was whether they had gone mad. Arthur led Estelle cautiously among the tents. The village contained about a dozen wigwams. Most of them were made of strips of birch bark, cleverly overlapping each other, the seams cemented with gum. All had hide flaps for doors. One or two were built almost entirely of hides, sewn together with strips of sinew. Arthur made only a cursory examination of the village. His principal motive in taking Estelle there was to give her some mental occupation to ward off the reaction from the excitement of the cataclysm. He looked into one or two of the tents and found merely couches of hides, with minor domestic utensils scattered about. He brought from one tent a bow and quiver of arrows. The workmanship was good, but very evidently the maker had no knowledge of metal tools. Arthur's acquaintance with archaeological subjects was very slight, but he observed that the arrowheads were chipped and not rubbed smooth. They were attached to the shafts with strips of gut or tendon. Arthur was still pursuing his investigation when a sob from Estelle made him stop and look at her. "Oh, what are we going to do?" she asked tearfully. "What are we going to do? Where are we?" "You mean, when are we?" Arthur corrected with a grim smile. "I don't know. Way back before the discovery of America, though. You can see in everything in the village there isn't a trace of European civilization. I expect that we are several thousand years back. I can't tell, of course, but this pottery makes me think so. See this bowl?" He pointed to a bowl of red clay lying on the ground before one of the wigwams. "If you'll look, you'll see that it isn't really pottery at all. It's a basket that was woven of reeds and then smeared with clay to make it fire-resisting. The people who made that didn't know about baking clay to make it stay put. When America was discovered, nearly all the tribes knew something about pottery." But what are we going to do? Estelle tearfully insisted.
We're going to muddle along as well as we can, answered Arthur cheerfully, until we can get back to where we started from. Maybe the people back in the 20th century can send a relief party after us. When the skyscraper vanished, it must have left a hole of some sort. It may be possible for them to follow us down.
If that's so, said Estelle quickly, well, why can't we climb up it without waiting for them to come after us?
Arthur scratched his head. He looked across the clearing at the skyscraper. It seemed to rest very solidly on the ground. He looked up. The sky seemed normal.
To tell the truth, he admitted, there doesn't seem to be any hole. I said that more to cheer you up than anything else.
Estelle clenched her hands tightly and took a grip on herself.
Just tell me the truth, she said quietly. I was rather foolish, but tell me what you honestly think.
Arthur eyed her keenly. In that case, he said reluctantly, I'll admit we're in a pretty bad fix. I don't know what has happened, how it happened, or anything about it. I'm just going to keep on going until I see a way clear to get out of this mess. There are 2,000 of us people, more or less, and among all of us we must be able to find a way out.
Estelle had turned very pale.
We're in no great danger from Indians, went on Arthur thoughtfully, or from anything else that I know of except one thing.
What is that? Asked Estelle quickly.
Arthur shook his head and led her back toward the skyscraper, which was now thronged with people from all the floors who had come down to the ground and were standing excitedly about the concourse, asking each other what had happened. Arthur led Estelle to one of the corners. Wait for me here, he ordered. I'm going to talk to this crowd. He pushed his way through until he could reach the confectionery and newsstand in the main hall. Here he climbed up on the counter and shouted, People, listen to me. I'm going to tell you what's happened.
In an instant, there was dead silence.
He found himself the center of a sea of white faces, everyone contorted with fear and anxiety. To begin with, he said confidently, there's nothing to be afraid of. We're going to get back to where we started from. I don't know how yet, but we'll do it. Don't get frightened. Now, I'll tell you what's happened. He rapidly sketched out for them in words as simple as he could make them, his theory that a flaw in the rock on which the foundations rested had developed and let the skyscraper sink not downward, but into the fourth dimension. I'm an engineer, he finished. What nature can do, we can imitate. Nature let us into this hole, we'll climb out. In the meantime, matters are serious. We needn't be afraid of not getting back, we'll do that. What we've got to fight is starvation.
Please join me next time for another exciting chapter of The Runaway Skyscraper by Murray Leinster. Here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. In the meantime, watch the sky.